Cassette 10, Side 2.
Dr. Bernstein? Huh? Gordon had been dozing in front of the scope. His eyes darted to the resonance lines, but they were undisturbed. Good. He had missed nothing. Only then did he look up at the slender man who stood inside the laboratory door. I'm from UPI. I'm doing a background story on the Ramsey-Hussinger results. They've excited an enormous amount of concern, you know. I thought I would look into the contributions made by other faculty to... Why come to me? Well, I could not help but notice that you were the man Professor Ramsey kept looking at during the press conference. I wondered if you might be the other sources Professor Ramsey recently admitted.
When did he say that?
Just yesterday while I was interviewing him. Shit. What was that, Doctor? You seem rather concerned. No, nothing. Look, I have nothing to say. Are you sure, Doctor? I said I have nothing to say. Now please leave. The man opened his mouth. Gordon jerked his thumb toward the door. Out, I said. Out. Gordon worked each day, gradually collecting fragments of sentences. They came out of sequence. The technical information was repetitious, probably to be sure it came through correctly, despite transmission and receiving errors. But why? He thought. This stuff fits my guesses, sure, but there must be an explanation in this text itself. A rational explanation, clearly set out. One evening he had a dream in which Uncle Herb was watching him play chess in Washington Square. His uncle frowned as Gordon moved the pieces across the squares and said over and over, in a disapproving voice, God forbid there should not be a rational explanation. On the morning of Monday, November 5th, he drove into work late. He'd gotten into a pointless argument with Penny over minor domestic matters. He turned on the car radio to take his mind off it. The lead news item was that Maria Guppert Mayer of UCLJ had won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Gordon was so stunned by the news, he barely recovered in time to make the turn at the top of Torrey Pines Road. A Lincoln blared its horn at him, and the driver, a man in a hat driving with his lights on, glared. Mayer had won the prize for the shell model of the nucleus. She shared it with Eugene Wigner of Princeton and Hans Jensen, a German who had devised the shell model at about the same time as Maria. The university held a press conference that afternoon. Maria Mayer was shy and soft-spoken beneath the barrage of questions. Gordon went to see. The questions asked were mostly dumb, but you expected that. The kindly woman who had stopped to inquire about his results when the rest of the department was ignoring him was now a Nobel Prize winner. The fact took a while to sink in. He had a sudden sense that things were converging at this place, this time. The research done here was important. There were the Carraways and their quasar riddle, Gell-Mann's arrays of particles, Dyson's visions, Marcuse and Maria Mayer and the news that Jonas Salk was coming to build an institute. La Jolla was a nexus. He was grateful to be here. Chapter 41, November 6th, 1963. The signal strength got abruptly better. There were whole paragraphs about the Wheeler-Feynman theory. Gordon called Claudia Zins to see if the Columbia group was getting the same results. No, not for 5 days now, she said. First we had some equipment failure, then the graduate student got the flu, the one that's been going around. I think he was overtired. Those times you gave us, that's 10-12 hours in the lab, Gordon.
You mean you have nothing?
Not for those days, no.
Can't you do some of the times yourself?
I will, starting tomorrow.
I do have other things to do, you know.
Sure, yes.
I want to have some confirmation, that's all.
We have that now, Gordon. Of the effect, I mean.
It's not only the effect that's important. Claudia, look back over those signals. Think about what it means.
Gordon, I don't think we know enough yet to...
Okay, I agree, basically. Most of my data is a jumble. Fragments, pieces of sentences, formulas, but there is a consistent feel to it.
Her voice took on the precise professional clarity he remembered from graduate school.
First the data, Gordon. Then we indulge in some theory, maybe.
Yeah, right.
He knew better than to argue with her on the philosophy of experimental physics. She had rather rigid views.
I promise you, I start up tomorrow.
Okay, but it could fade by then. I mean,
don't kvetch, Gordon. Tomorrow we start again.
It came less than 3 hours later, shortly after noon on Tuesday, November 6th. Names, dates, the spreading bloom. The phrases describing this were clipped and tense. Parts were garbled. Letters were missing. One long passage, though, related how the experiments had begun and who was involved. These sentences were longer and more relaxed and almost conversational, as though someone were simply sending what came into his head.
With Markham gone and bloody dumb Renfrew carrying on, there's no future in our little plan, no past either. I suppose the language can't deal with it, but the thing should have worked if...
There came a scramble of noise. The long passage disappeared and did not return. The terse biological information reappeared. They were missing words. The noise was rising like a tossing sea. Through the last staccato sentences, there ran an unstated sense of desperation. Penny saw something different in his face when he came into the kitchen. Her raised eyebrows asked a question.
I got it today.
He surprised himself at the easy, blank way he could say it.
Got what?
The answer, for Christ's sake.
Oh. Oh.
Gordon handed her a Xerox copy of his lab notebook.
So it really is the way you thought?
Apparently. There was a quiet assurance in him now. He felt no pressing need to say anything about the result, no tension, not even a hint of the manic elation he had expected. The facts were there at last, and they could speak for themselves.
My God, Gordon.
Yeah, my God indeed.
There was a moment of silence between them. She put the Xerox page on the kitchen table and turned back to deboning a chicken.
Well, that should take care of your promotion.
It sure as hell should, Gordon said with some relish.
And maybe,
she gave him a sidelong look,
maybe you'll be worth living with again.
The sentence had started out all right, but by the end, a bitter tone came into it. Gordon pursed his lips, irked.
You haven't made it any easier.
There are limits, Gordon.
Uh-huh.
I'm not your goddamn little wifey.
Yes, you made that brilliantly clear some time ago.
She sniffed, lips pressed so tight they grew pale, and wiped her hands on a paper towel. Penny reached over and clicked on the radio. It began playing a chubby checker tune. Gordon stepped forward and turned it off. She looked at him, saying nothing. Gordon picked up the Xeroxed page and put it in his jacket pocket, carefully folding it beforehand. He said, I think I'll go do some reading.
You do that, she said.
All through the afternoon of November 7th, the noise level rose. It blotted out the signal most of the time. Gordon got a few words here and there, and a very clear RA18536DEC3029.2, and that was all. The coordinates made sense now. Up ahead in the future, they would have a precise fix on where they would seem to be in the sky. The solar apex was an average of the sun's motion. 35 years from now, the Earth would be in a location near the average motion. Gordon felt a certain relaxing in him as he watched the jittering noise. All the pieces fit now. Zins could confirm at least a part of it. Now the question was how to present the data, how to build a case that couldn't be dismissed out of hand. A straightforward paper in the physical review? Well, that would be the standard approach. The lead time on Phys Rev was at least 9 months, though. He could publish in physical review letters, but letters had to be short. How could he pack in all the experimental detail, plus the messages? Gordon smiled ruefully. Here he had an enormous result, and he was dithering over how to present it. Showbiz. Penny carried knives and forks to the table. Gordon brought the plates. The slatted blinds let in yellow swords of sun. She moved gracefully in this light, her face pensive. They ate silently for a moment, both hungry. "I thought about your experiments again today," she began hesitantly. "Yes?" "I don't understand them. To think of time that way." "I don't see how it can make sense either. It's a fact, though." "Facts rule." "Well, sure. I kind of feel we're looking at this the wrong way, though. Space-time must not work the way physicists think." She nodded and pushed potatoes around her plate, still pensive. "Thomas Wolfe. Time. Dark time. Secret time. Forever flowing like a river. I remember that from The Web and the Rock." "I haven't read it." "I looked up a Dobson poem today, thinking about you." She took a paper from her books and handed it to him. "Time goes, you say. Ah, no. Alas, time stays. We go." He laughed. "Yeah, something like that." He cut into a Frankfurter with enthusiasm. "Do you think people like Lakin are going to keep on questioning your work?" He chewed judiciously. "Well, in the best sense, I hope they do. Every result in science has to stand up to criticism every day. Results have to be checked and rethought."
"No, I meant..."
"I know. Are they going to try to cut me off at the knees?" "I hope so." He grinned. "If they push things further than legitimate scientific skepticism, they'll have just that much farther to fall."
"Well, I hope not."
"Why?"
"Because..."
Her voice broke.
"It'll be hard on you, and I can't take what it does to you anymore."
"Honey,
I can't. You've been tight as a drum all summer and fall. And when I try to deal with it, I can't get through to you. And I start snapping at you and..." "Honey, things get so impossible. I just..."
"God, I know. It runs away with me," she said quietly.
"And me.
I start thinking about a problem and other things, other people. They just seem to get in the way.
It's been my fault, too. I want a lot out of this, out of us. So much, and I'm not getting it."
"We've been clawing at each other." She sighed.
"Yeah.
I think the physics stuff isn't going to be so bad from now on."
That's what I hope. I mean, these last few days, they've been different. Better. It feels like a year ago, really. You're relaxed. I'm not bugging you all the time to... I feel better about us. For the first time in ages."
"Yeah.
Me too."
He smiled tentatively. They ate in a comfortable silence. In the moist sunset glow, Penny swirled her glass of white wine and gazed at the ceiling, thinking. Gordon knew they had made an unspoken pledge. Penny began to smile, her eyes hazed. She sipped more of the amber wine and plunged a fork into a Frankfurter. Holding it aloft with a wise smile, she turned it this way and that, studying it critically.
"Yours is bigger than this,"
she said judiciously. Gordon nodded solemnly. "Maybe. That's, what, about 30 centimeters?
Yeah, I can beat that.
In matters of this kind, the preferred unit system is inches. It's sort of traditional.
So it is.
Not that I'm a purist, you understand.
Oh, no, I wouldn't think that.
He awoke with an arm that had gone to sleep. He gently rolled her head off his bicep and lay still, feeling the tingling ebb away. Outside, the balmy fall night had descended. He sat up slowly and she snuggled to him, murmuring. He studied the rounded knuckles of her curved spine, knobbed hills amid the brown sweep of skin. He thought of time that could flow and loop back on itself, unlike any river, and his eyes followed the narrowing of her back. Then came the flaring into hips, a complex of smooth surfaces descending to the ripe swelling below, the tan fading into a startling pure white. Drowsy, she had solemnly informed him that Lawrence had called his a pillar of blood, a phrase that struck her as grotesque. But on the other hand, she added, it was sort of like that, wasn't it? All in pursuit of la petite mort, she murmured, and slid into sleep. Gordon knew she had been right about the tension between them. It was seeping away now. He saw that he had loved her all along, but there had been so much in the way. He heard a distant siren. Something made him slowly untangle himself from her. He moved across the cold floor to the window. He could see people walking along La Jolla Boulevard under a bleached neon glow. A motorcycle cop raced by. The police here were jackbooted and military, with eggshell helmets, goggles, their square faces a frozen blank, like actors in a futuristic anticipation, a B-grade black and white. In New York, the cops were soft, their uniforms a worn neighborhood blue. The siren shrieked. A police car flashed by. Buildings, palms, turning heads, shops and signs all pulsed red in response to the revolving hysterical light atop the streaking car. Fragments of red ricocheted from store windows. Kinetic confusion swept by, wailing, its mechanical mouth announcing tumult. The Doppler death of this shriek stirred pedestrians, filling their steps with new energy. Heads pivoted to seek the crime or fire that had drawn the bullet-like car. Gordon thought of the messages and the thin thread of desperation that ran through them. A siren. It had come in speckled dabs, impulses, light reflected from random waves, visions from far across a river. It should be answered. For scientific reasons, yes, but for more than that.
You busy?
It was Cooper. No, come on in. Gordon pushed the pile of papers he was grading to the corner of his desk. Then he leaned back in his chair and put his feet up on top of them. He clasped his hands behind his neck, elbows out, and grinned. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm going to take my exam again in 3 weeks, you know. What do I say about those interruptions? I mean, Lakin and the others came down on me like a shitload of bricks last time.
Right. If I were you, I would ignore the point.
But I can't. They'll cream me again.
I'll take care of them.
Huh? How?
I'll have a little work of my own to present by that time.
Well, I don't know. Getting Lakin off my back is non-trivial. You saw the way he...
Why do you say non-trivial? Why not hard or difficult?
Well, you know, it's physics talk.
Yes, physics talk. We have a lot of jargon like that. I wonder if sometimes it doesn't disguise things rather than making them clearer. Cooper gave Gordon an odd look.
I guess.
Don't look so uncertain, Gordon said jovially. You're home free. I'm going to save your ass.
Okay.
Cooper moved uncertainly to the door.
If you say so.
See you on the ramparts, Gordon said by way of dismissal. He was about a quarter of the way through the first draft of his paper for science when there was a knock on his door. He had decided on science because it was big and prestigious and got things into print fairly quickly. They carried long articles so he could tell the whole thing in one piece, stacking up the evidence in a pile so high No one could knock it down. He had already checked with Claudia Zins. She would publish a letter in the same issue, confirming some of his observations.
Hello, can we come in?
It was the twins, first-year graduate students. Well, look, I'm pretty busy.
It's your office hours.
It is? Oh, yes. Well, what did you want?
You graded some of our problems wrong,
one of them said. The flat statement took Gordon aback. He was used to a little more humility from students.
Oh?
He countered.
Yeah, look.
One of them began to write rapidly on Gordon's blackboard, covering up some notes Gordon had put there while he was outlining his paper. Gordon tried to follow the argument the twin was making. Careful of that stuff I have written there. The twin frowned at Gordon's intruding lines.
Okay,
he said democratically and began to write around them. Gordon focused his attention on the rapid-fire sentences about Bessel's functions and boundary conditions on the electric field. It took him 5 minutes to straighten out the twins' misconception. All through it, he was never sure which one of the twins he was talking to. They were virtually carbon copies. As soon as one finished, the other would leap to the attack with a new objection, usually phrased in a cryptic few words. Gordon found them exceptionally tiring. After 10 more minutes, during which they began to interrogate him about his research and how much money a research assistant made, he finally got rid of them by pleading a headache. That, plus 3 significant glances at his watch, got them out the door. As he was closing it, another voice called,
Wait a sec, Dr. Bernstein!
Gordon reluctantly opened it. The man from UPI stepped partway in.
I know you don't want to be bothered, Professor.
Right, so why are you bothering me?
Because Professor Ramsey blew the story to me just now, that's why.
What story?
About you and those chain molecules. Where you got the picture in the first place. How you wanted it kept secret. I've got it all. The works.
The man beamed at him. Why did Ramsey tell you?
I worked out some of it. He didn't paper over the seams in his story very well. Not a very good liar, Ramsey.
I suppose not.
He wasn't going to tell me anything, but I remembered that thing you were involved in a while back.
Gordon said with sudden fatigue. Saul Schriffer?
Yeah, he's the guy. Me, I put 2 and 2 together. I went to see Ramsey for some more backgrounding, and in the middle of it, I popped in with that one.
And he babbled like a brook.
You got it.
Gordon sagged into his chair. He sat there, slumped down, staring at the man from United Press International.
Well,
the man said. He took out a notebook.
You going to tell me, Professor?
I don't appreciate being grilled.
Well, sorry if I offended you, Professor. I'm not grilling you. I just did a little sniffing around and...
Okay, I'm sensitive about that.
It's going to come out sometime, you know. The Ramsey-Hussinger thing hasn't gotten any real attention in the papers so far. I know, but it's going to be important. People are going to be hearing about it. Your part could be valuable.
In a dreamy way, Gordon began to laugh softly. Could be valuable, he said, and laughed again. The man frowned.
Hey, look, you are going to tell me, aren't you?
Gordon felt an odd, seeping tiredness in himself. He sighed. I suppose I am. Chapter 42. Gordon had not realized the lights would be so bright. There were banks of lamps to both sides of the small platform to make his face shadow-free. A TV camera's snout peered at him, an unwinking cyclops. There were some chemists in the audience and nearly all the physics department. The department draftsman had labored until midnight to get all the charts drawn. Gordon had found the staff a great help in hustling things together for this. He was beginning to realize that the hostility he had felt from them all was an illusion, a product of his own doubts. The last few days had been a revelation. Department members hailed him in the hall, listened intently to his descriptions of his data, and visited the lab. He looked around for Penny.
There, near the back, in a pink dress. She smiled wanly at his hand wave. The pressmen were murmuring to each other and finding seats. The TV crewmen were in place, and a woman with a microphone gave last-minute instructions. Gordon counted the crowd. Incredibly, it was larger than the number who had turned out for Maria Mayer's Nobel conference. But then, this one had a day or two of lead time. The UPI man got his exclusive story, picked up by the other wire services, and then the university had stepped in and set up this dog and pony show. Gordon riffled through his notes with damp fingers. He had not really wanted any of this. The feel of it seemed somehow wrong to him. Science carried out in public, science elbowing for time on the 6 o'clock news, science as a commodity. The momentum of it was immense. In the end, they would remain the article in Science, where his results had to meet their tests, where no amount of bias for or against him could tip the scales. Dr. Bernstein, we're ready. He wiped his brow one last time. Okay, shoot. A green light winked on. He looked into the camera and tried to smile.
Chapter 43, 1998. Peterson pulled the car into the brick garage and hauled out the suitcases. Puffing, he set them outside on the path to the farmhouse. The garage doors locked with a reassuring clank. A biting wind was blowing off the North Sea, sweeping cleanly across the flat East Anglian landscape. He pulled up the collar of his sheepskin jacket. No sign of movement from the house. Probably no one had heard the car's quiet purr. He decided to take a walk around, to survey and stretch his legs. His head bounced. He needed the air. He'd stayed in a Cambridge hotel overnight when the sudden sinking feeling came over him again. He slept through most of the morning and came down expecting lunch. The hotel was deserted. So were the streets outside. There were signs of life in the houses nearby, chimney smoke and an orange glow of lamps. Peterson didn't stop to inquire. He drove out of a bleak and empty Cambridge and up through the flat, somber fen country. He rubbed his hands together more in satisfaction than to keep them warm. For a while there, when the illness first struck him again outside London, he had thought he'd never make it this far. The roads had been clogged on the way from London, and then next day, north of Cambridge, strangely empty. He had seen overturned lorries and burning barns north of Bury St. Edmunds. By Stowmarket, a gang tried to hail him down. They had axes and hoes. He had ploughed straight through them, sending bodies into the air like bowling pins. But here the farm lay quiet beneath the rolling grey clouds of East Anglia. Ranks of leafless trees marked the field boundaries. Black blobs hung in the latticework of bare twigs, rooks' nests framed against the sky. He tramped through the western field, legs weak, the black mud sticking to his boots. To his right, cows stood patiently by a gate, their breath steaming in the air, waiting to be led home to their shed. The harvest had been cut 2 weeks ago. He'd ordered that. The field stood wide and empty now. Let them lie. There was time. He circled round through the sugar beet acres to the old stone house. It looked deceptively run down. The only visible new note was a glass conservatory jutting to the south. The panes had cross-hatchings of wire embedded, quite secure. Years ago, when he'd first begun, he'd decided on a system totally buried, completely isolated. The greenhouse had filtered water and fertilizers. Water tanks under the northern field held a year's supply. The greenhouse could produce a reasonable supply of vegetables for a long time. That, and the stores buried under the house and barn, would provide ample backup. He had hired it done, of course, using laborers from distant towns. He'd had the vast coal bin filled from Cambridge rather than nearby Durham. The mines in the fields and along the one road capable of being armed either on command or by the detection system, he'd had a mercenary installed. Peterson had arranged that the man be hired on some Pacific operation soon after, and he'd not returned. The electronic watchdogs that dotted the farm he had brought in from California and hired a technical type from London to do up. Thus, no one person knew the extent of the operation. Only his uncle knew it all, and he was the grimly silent sort. Bloody boring company, though. For a moment he regretted not bringing Sarah, but she would be the high-strung type out here, unable to bear the sameness of the long days. Of all the women he'd had in the past year, Marjorie Renfrew was the one most likely to fit in. She knew something of farming, and had turned out to be unexpectedly lusty. She had seen the need in him when he'd stumbled in last night, and had met it with an instinctive passion. Beyond that, though, he couldn't imagine living with her for even a week. She would talk and bustle about, fretting, alternately criticizing and mothering him. No, the only companions he could imagine for what lay ahead were men. He thought of Greg Markham. There was someone you could have trusted not to trip and shoot you in the back in a deer hunt or run away from an adder. Intelligent conversation and companionable silence. Judgment and a certain perspective. Still, it was going to be difficult without a woman. He probably should have spent more time on that, not dwelled in Sarah's butterfly crowd. No matter how the world struggled out of the present muck, with hard times, attitudes would change. There would be no more of what the social science lot called free sexuality, which to Peterson was simply getting what he'd always thought the world owed anybody. Women of all kinds and shapes and flavors. As people, they varied, of course, but as tickets to a side of life beyond the brittle intellect, they were remarkably alike, sisters sharing the same magic. He had tried to understand his own attitude in terms of psychological theory, but had come away convinced the simple flat fact of living went beyond those categories. No convenient ideas worked. It wasn't ego-enforcing or disguised aggression. It wasn't a clever cover for some imagined homosexuality. He'd had a taste of that when young, and found it thin gruel indeed, thanks. It was something beyond the analytical chat level. Women were part of that world-swallowing he had always sought, a way of keeping oneself sensual, but not stupefied by glut. So in the last year, he had tried them all, pursued every possibility. He had known for a long while that something was coming. The fragile pyramid with him near the top would crumble. He'd enjoyed what would soon pass, women and all the rest, and now felt no regrets. When you sail on the Titanic, there's no point in going steerage. He wondered idly how many of the futurologists had got out. Few, he would guess. Their ethereal scenarios seldom talked about individual responses. They had looked away uncomfortably on that Northern African field trip. The personal was, compared with the tides of great nations, a bothersome detail. He approached the stone house, noting with approval how ordinary and even shabby it looked. "You're back, my lord." Peterson whirled. A man approached, pushing a bicycle. A man from the village, he noted quickly. Work trousers, faded jacket, high boots. "Yes, I've come home for good." "Ah, good it is. Safe harbour in these days, eh? I've brought your bacon and dried beef, I has." "Oh, very good." Peterson accepted the cartons. "You'll just put them on the account, then?" He kept his voice as matter-of-fact as he could. "Well, I was meaning to speak to the house," he nodded, pointing to the farmhouse. "About that." "You can deal with me." "Right. Well, as things is happening, I'd appreciate payment on the day, you see." "Well, I see no reason why not. And I'd like payment in goods, if you please." "Goods? Well, money's no good now, is it? Some of your vegetables, perhaps. Tin goods is what we truly like." "Oh." Peterson tried to judge the man, who was giving him a fixed smile, one that had other interpretations than simple friendliness. I suppose we can do a bit of that, yes. We don't have many tin goods, however. We'd like them, though, sir. Was there an edge to his voice? I'll see what we can do. That'll be fine, sir. The man sketched a brief gesture of touching a forelock, as though he were a retainer, and Peterson the squire. Peterson stood still as the man swung onto his bicycle and pedalled off. There had been enough of parody in the gesture to give the entire conversation a different cast. He watched the man leave the property without looking back. Frowning, he turned towards the house. He went round behind the hedge, avoiding the garden, and crossed the farmyard. From the hen house came low, contented cluckings. By the door, he scraped his boots on the old iron scraper, and then tossed them down in the passageway just inside the door. He slipped on some house shoes and hung up his jacket. The large kitchen was warm and bright. He'd put in modern appliances, but left the flagged stone floor worn smooth by centuries of use, and the huge fireplace and the old oak settle. His uncle and aunt sat on either side of the fire in comfortable high-backed wing chairs, as silent and motionless as iron fire dogs. In its place, at the head of the table, the big round teapot sat under its quilted cozy. Roland, the farmhouse factotum, silently set the plate of scones, pats of sweet butter, and a dish of homemade strawberry jam on the table. He crossed to the fire to warm his hands. His aunt, seeing him, gave a start. "Well, bless my soul, it's Ian." She leaned forward and tapped her husband on the knee. "Henry, look who's here. It's Ian, come to see us. Isn't that nice?"
"He's come to live with us, Dot," his uncle answered patiently.
"Oh," she said, puzzling. "Oh, where's that pretty girl of yours then, Ian? Where's Andrilla?"
"Sarah," he corrected automatically. "She stayed in London."
"Pretty girl, but flighty. Well, let's have tea." She threw back the rug from her legs. Roland came forward and lifted her to a seat by the teapot. They all sat round the table. Roland was a big man, slow-moving. He'd been with the family 2 decades. "Look, Roland, here's Ian, come to visit." Peterson sighed. His aunt had been senile for years. Only her husband and Roland had any continuity in her mind.
"Ian's come to live with us," his uncle repeated.
"Where are the children?" she asked. "They're late." No one reminded her that both sons had drowned in a sailing accident some 15 years before. They waited patiently for the daily ritual to be completed. "Well, let's not wait for them." She picked up the heavy teapot and began to pour the strong steaming tea into the striped blue and white farmhouse cups. They ate in silence. Outside, the rain that had threatened all day began to fall, tentatively at first, pattering against the windows, then more steadily. Distantly, the cows, disturbed by the drumming of the rain on the roof of their shed, lowed mournfully.
"It's raining,"
his uncle volunteered. No one answered. He liked their silence, and when they spoke, their flat East Anglian vowels slid like balm into his ears, slow and soothing. His childhood nurse had been a Suffolk woman. He finished his tea and went into the library. He fingered the cut glass decanter, decided against a drink. The steady sound of pouring rain was muted by the heavy oak shutters. They'd been well made, concealing a panel of steel. He had turned the place into a fortress. It would withstand a lengthy siege. The cowsheds and barn were double-walled and connected by tunnels to the house. All doors were double with heavy bolts. Every room was a miniature armory. He stroked a rifle on the library wall. He checked the chamber, oiled and loaded, as he had ordered. He chose a cigar and dropped into his leather armchair.
He picked up a book that lay waiting. A morn. He began to read. Roland came in and built a fire. Its rich crackling cut the edge of cold in the room. There would be time later to review the stocks of provisions and lay out a dietary plan. No outside water, at least for a while. No more trips into the village. He settled further into the chair, aware that things needed doing, but not for the moment feeling up to it. His limbs were sore, and the sudden flashes of weakness still came upon him. Here he was still Peterson, of Peter's Manor, and he let the sense of that sweep through him, bringing a kind of inner rest. Was it Russell who had said that no man is truly comfortable far from the environment of his childhood? There was some truth in that. But the fellow from the village just now... Peterson frowned. They really couldn't use the bacon any longer. Everything would be blighted with the cloud stuff, at least for a while. The village man probably knew that, and beneath the Yes, My Lord manor, there had been a clear threat. He had come to barter security, not bacon. Give them some tinned food, and all would be well. Peterson moved in the chair restlessly. All his life he had been in motion, he thought. He had moved up from this landed gentry role through Cambridge and into the government. He had used each level and then moved on. Sarah, he supposed, was the most recent clear case, not forgetting the council itself. They had all helped. The government itself had, of course, followed much the same strategy. Modern economics and the welfare state borrowed heavily on the future. Now, he was in a place he could not leave. He had to depend on those around him, and suddenly he was uncomfortably aware that this small, easily managed band in the manor and the village were free agents too. Once society faltered, what became of the ordering that had kept Peter's manor calm and safe? Peterson sat in the waning light of day and thought, a finger tapping on the arm of his chair. He tried to begin again with his book, but it held no interest for him. Through the window, he could see the cut fields that stretched to the horizon. A north wind stirred the crisp outline of the trees. Dusk fell. The fire popped.
This ends side two of cassette 10 of Timescape. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 11.